Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the consequences of our faith in science? While humans once relied on priests and shamans to cure what ailed them, modern citizens of industrialized countries tend to put the same sort of trust in doctors, researchers, and drug manufacturers to fix what is wrong in our lives. Our belief in salvation through science has changed the way we talk about problems, from alcohol to pain to major depression. But are we really any closer to the truth? My guest today is not so sure. Gary Greenberg is a psychotherapist and a freelance writer. His new book is called The Noble Lie, When Scientists Give the Right Answers for the Wrong Reasons. Gary, welcome back to Think.
Hi there, Chris.
You say that in the modern world, diseases are not so much discovered as they are invented. What's the difference?
Well, when we say that we've discovered a disease, it's as if we've discovered something that actually exists in nature. And of course, sometimes that's true, or at least we approximate that, like when you find the bacteria that causes an infection.
But what social forces then shape our definition of what can be classified as a disease?
Well, the biggest social force that shapes it is our understanding of what makes for a good life. And a disease is something that interferes with having a good life. Something usually that we think, at least we think, arises in the body and affects what we generally call our health.
So it causes discomfort and makes us different from everybody else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, the noble lie is a concept put forward by Socrates as a way to sort of stabilize society by convincing people that their social status was predetermined. Does it work the same way for us when it's applied to the way we define disease?
Well, and it may not necessarily reinforce our social status, but it does work for us in a similar way by reassuring us that the problems that our doctors are treating really do exist in nature, and the ways that they're urging us to get better really are ways that make us put us back in harmony with nature.
And the idea, I suppose, is that if something exists in nature, then we have the power through science to do something about it. We are more powerful than whatever it is that bothers us.
That's right. And in addition to that, it also means that when science is curing it, there's nothing really controversial about it. We're just being restored to a state of nature rather than being changed into something else.
You write about the fact that these days, very often, drug companies will launch a disease, and you use that phrase, as part of marketing a new product. For example, restless leg syndrome. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, restless leg syndrome is a good example of disease mongering. It's something that the drug companies have had to do as the most obvious targets for drugs have been discovered and treated, which is something that, by the way, the pharmaceutical companies are extremely good at. But as time has gone on, and there have been fewer and fewer major infectious diseases, for instance, to find drugs for, they've gotten more into the business of figuring out how to take other kinds of suffering that we wouldn't necessarily think of as a disease, and turn it into a disease that just miraculously happens to be treated by a drug that they've created. In the case of restless leg syndrome, the drug companies had a medicine that wasn't really doing very well as an anti-Parkinson's drug. But in clinical trials, it turned out to make some people who reported trouble sleeping because of twitchy legs, it helped them to sleep better. And so even before they got the FDA approval to treat this restless leg syndrome, the drug company started to promote the idea that there was such a disease in the first place. And it was pretty successful. It turned the drug into a better performer.
So the treatment drives the definition, or at least in this case, the awareness of this as a condition. Had restless leg syndrome been identified as a disease before this?
Yes, vaguely. There were references to it in the literature, and if I was more familiar with my own book, I could tell you exactly what the difference was. But there was a substantial increase in not just reports of it, but in writing about it in the medical literature. So it was taking a problem that had been noted and making it a much more important and official problem.
So why wouldn't something that treats RLS represent a breakthrough for people who really did suffer from something that before this nobody could really explain?
I don't think there's any question that it does. Mm-hmm. It helps people. Drugs do work. And in this case, people with that problem could take the drug and feel better.
But then there are other kinds of things that we don't necessarily agree are diseases, or at least we haven't always agreed that they're diseases, that have been pathologized. Things like, for example, alcoholism.
Yeah, alcoholism is a good example, because what we see with alcoholism and the way it has been turned into a disease is that it was really a benevolent effort, just as with Plato's noble lie. It's an effort to take a problem that isn't really getting dealt with very well. This is back in the 1940s, and certainly wasn't being taken care of by doctors, and to bring it under the umbrella of medicine. And the best way to do that was to start to develop the idea that alcoholism is a disease. And the idea for this actually came from a public relations expert who had been hired by a group of doctors who were interested in treating alcoholism to help them understand how they best could get public recognition of alcoholism as a disease. And he advised them actually how to get alcoholism brought under their umbrella, and he advised them to turn it into a disease. He made it really clear that if you want to get the people on your side, then what you do is you claim that the problem is a medical disease and therefore doctors should treat it.
And then that claim that alcoholism was in fact a disease was largely crafted by someone who did not have a scientific background and had not specifically researched alcoholism.
Right. It was crafted by a fellow named Edward Jelinek, who had a tremendous flair for self-promotion and also a facility with statistics, much as your previous guest was describing, and could use these he became sort of an impresario of alcoholism as a disease. He developed a center for studying it, and he developed the model, and ultimately was asked, in the course of writing a book, he asked himself the question, so what does it mean to say alcoholism is a disease? And his answer to that question is, a disease is whatever a physician says a disease is.
We have an email here that was actually written to us in the last hour, but I thought worked just as well for this one. Celine in Fort Worth writes, in the midst of the great flu scare, Cece Connolly wrote a very long piece for the Washington Post that contained a short paragraph that told the truth. Pharmaceutical companies, this is quoting now, were directed to develop millions of vaccines. This would jumpstart the industry. And she says, as always, follow the money. How often is that behind the way we look at disease?
I think more often than I would wish, but less often than a conspiracy theorist would say. I think it's pretty clearly behind the epidemic of depression, for example. I think that if you just look at the way that that particular problem has unfolded, bringing so much of human unhappiness under the disease umbrella, there's no question that that would not have happened if it weren't for the antidepressant revolution.
Yeah, we've talked about this in an earlier show, but you volunteered for a study on mild depression at Mass General as a patient, thinking that you probably had mild depression. But in fact, you were diagnosed in a really different way. Can you talk about how you were feeling and then what you were told about your condition?
Well, I'm just your typical, melancholic person who's been suffering under the Bush administration for 8 years. And so when a study came up that was for what they actually call minor depression, I thought, well, I qualify for that because all you need to do is to be unhappy more often than not for a period of 2 weeks and have one of the other 9 symptoms of depression, which can include sleep troubles. So I volunteered for the trial. I was not allowed into the trial, however, because on the tests anyway, I came up as having major depression.
Even though you did not feel that you were suffering from major depression?
Well, I'm a therapist, and I think I know major depression when I meet it, or at least what's supposed to be major depression. And usually, first, for starters, it's a tremendous effort for a person just to get into my office who's really in the throes of a major depression. And they're generally really subdued and tearful, and it's a kind of a presentation that they make that's pretty common up to that diagnosis. And I'd driven 80 miles to Boston to be there, and I thought pretty, I don't know, for me, affable, which some other people might think was still pretty prickly. But in any event, I was animated and alive, and so I just thought on the face of it, it didn't make sense.
So now some people would look at this and say, well, you were just in denial, which is, of course, oddly enough, a symptom of a lot of mental illnesses.
Well, sure. Anytime somebody tells you you're mentally ill, you got to be careful about telling them that you disagree, because that just makes the diagnosis more certain.
So once you were in this study, you felt like you were being prepped for your recovery. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, Well, yeah, I mean, you have to understand that the placebo effect is an extremely important factor in any medical treatment, especially in psychological treatments, and even more especially in antidepressant treatments. And the placebo effect has much to do with expectation. And what was interesting to me was that in the course of my trial, I was often told that I was getting better. And not only that, but without directly doing so, simply by the nature of the questions they're asking you about, you know, how your digestion is and how you're sleeping and things that you might not have even associated with your depression, suddenly you're paying attention to a group of so-called symptoms that, as you monitor them, come to be your definition of depression. And it happens that antidepressants do affect a lot of those physical neurovegetative signs.
So before people start calling and say that you're denying that depression exists, it's not about that at all. Your concern really is that by calling certain things diseases and sort of assuming that they cannot be cured except by one path, we really stop talking about what else may be at play.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that it may not, just for convenience sake, I think we can make some kind of a distinction between depression, as an example, as a disease that afflicts enough people to really be a concern, but nowhere near the 20% of the population that the statistics say it does. And the problem is that when you tell people that their, in this case, unhappiness or any other kind of suffering is an illness, it puts them in a certain direction for cure, and it directs their attention away from other problems, social problems, for instance.
So they feel as if the only reason for their unhappiness is that they have a medical condition.
Yes, I mean, I can give you an example from my practice. A woman who was suffering in a pretty bad marriage, and a marriage in which she was pretty deeply oppressed by a fairly abusive husband. And, you know, she was unhappy, and she went to her doctor, and she got drugs, and the drugs made her feel a lot better. And 2 or 3 years later, when a crisis hit her marriage, she was reluctant to go back on antidepressants because her concern was that once again, once she took them, things might look okay to her. Hmm. And which was very frightening to me because in her case, she was in an extremely fragile condition. But she had learned in the course of taking them and not taking them that all she'd really done was directed her attention away from the material conditions of her life into her neurotransmitters. And in retrospect, she thought that was a mistake.
It's hard to test for a disease like depression or some of the other things that you've written about. And we'll talk after the break about addiction. But what sort of clinical criteria would you set up to sort of change the way we frame this discussion?
Well, I think that I don't know the answer to how I would answer that question, because what I would be more interested in doing is wondering if we really have to be so certain of our diagnoses in some of these cases in order to do what we're trying to do in the first place.
Huh.
In many cases, and not just depression, I don't know if we have time to talk about brain death before the break.
Probably we've got about 15 seconds, so we'll hold off on
time.
Brain death.
No, that would kill my brain. So, but you know, there are situations in which it's unnecessary to call something an illness. All calling it an illness does is end debate prematurely. But it's certainly you can get the treatment without the disease.
Gary Greenberg is my guest. His new book is called The Noble Lie: When Scientists Give the Right Answers for the Wrong Reasons. We will return to our discussion in just a moment, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gary Greenberg. His new book is called The Noble Lie, When Scientists Give the Right Answers for the Wrong Reasons. If you want to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. And before the break, Gary, of course, we were talking about our fundamental need for a concrete diagnosis, and this idea that we are uncomfortable with mystery or with ambiguity. And what's so interesting about that is that it would seem that that was what drove us from the hands of the priests and the shamans to cure our ills into the medical community to begin with.
You mean trying to solve those mysteries?
Trying to solve the mysteries and find that we had arrived at the truth about something.
And the great thing is that in so many respects that was vastly superior, successful to what had come before. I mean, there's a reason that we put so much faith in science, which is that science is pretty reliable up to its limits.
But then I suppose there are limits that we are having a hard time accepting?
Well, once science sort of makes it hard to believe in the supernatural anymore or the other methods of explanation, then where do you anchor your sense of what's true? I mean, that's a big problem. Science can tell us why it's not a good idea necessarily to believe in God, for instance. You can read the Richard Dawkins book about that very subject. But it doesn't do such a good job at giving us something else to believe in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jim in Granbury. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris. I like your show a lot.
Thank you.
You just beat me to the big question about religion and spirituality and God and all of that as being our help and salvation in this world. I'd like to ask Dr. Greenberg if he's heard of Charles Taylor, the philosopher.
Oh, sure. I've been up at McGill University.
Oh, you have?
Uh-huh.
Why am I not surprised? Have you seen his new book on a secular age?
Yes, I have, but I haven't read it.
It's a frog strangler. It's over 800 pages, but I haven't read it either, Dr. Greenberg, but I've started it, and it's amazing. I appreciate hearing you. I really
a frog
do.
Strangler? I've never heard that before.
This is Texas. We get all kinds of great expressions.
Yeah, I would have called it a doorstop.
Jim, thanks so much for your call. I wonder if the idea that we have mysteries that we can't accept and there are limitations to science, people who are automatically going to push against those are the people who ultimately achieve breakthroughs and find solutions to things.
That's right, yes. I mean, it's a good thing that people are curious and trying to get to the truth of the matter.
But obviously definitions can be a problem, and the demand that they exist is a problem. Let's get to that brain death question now and talk about the times in which this really does pose a serious ethical problem for people.
Yes, or more to the point, what happens is that science intervenes in a way that takes the ethical question off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of brain death, what happened is that in the late 60s, there were two problems that arose almost simultaneously. One of them was that advanced technology had made it possible to keep people who were severely brain injured alive indefinitely on respirators and, in intensive care units. And at the same time, technology had evolved to the point that organ transplant was a reality. And in the case of organ transplant, the problem was getting organs. The best kind of an organ is one that's taken out of a living body. Because once the heart stops beating, your organs start to die. So that's, for obvious reasons, not a viable alternative. You can't just take people's organs out. At the same time, the question of what to do with people on the respirators was that you could unplug them or disconnect them. Unfortunately, once you disconnected them, their organs started to die. So what happened was that the definition of death was changed so that if a person on a respirator's brain stopped functioning completely and irreversibly, that person was declared dead so that their organs could be removed while they were still viable. And what this accomplished was it created a concept that sounded biological, that is death. It doesn't get much more biological than that. So that the pretense could be carried on that these people were not having their organs removed while they were still alive, but the fact was their hearts were still beating and they were still breathing, which was, by anybody's definition in 1968, They were still, they were alive.
So we created this new definition as a sort of workaround so that
yes.
we could...
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, it probably couldn't have happened 5 years later after Roe v. Wade, but prior to Roe v. Wade, this was the way to solve the problem. And what it meant was that organ transplant could go forward, and people who had, you know, suffered the horror of brain death and their families could have the redemption of donating their organs. It was a good thing. But the fact is that biologically speaking, strictly from a scientific point of view, brain death is not a scientific category. It's a legal distinction. It's a philosophical distinction, but it was hidden. It was disguised as a scientific distinction.
So what would we gain, Gary, or maybe we wouldn't, if we were to eliminate the noble lie in a case like brain death and make this an issue that, whereas right now most people sort of agree on what it means and the definition is familiar to people, if we were to take that off the table and start this argument in earnest?
Yeah, what would we gain? Well, we'd gain a lot of late-night talk show hosts yelling at each other and stuff like that.
We've got enough of those.
Yeah, right. So, you know, I'm not sure I'm in favor of that. It all depends on how much value you place on the truth, because that's the only thing you would gain. You would gain truth, because the truth is that a person who's in that brain-dead state is, you know, is hopelessly compromised, but they're only dead if you think that consciousness is what constitutes human life. And you'd have to decide how important is it to have that discussion of whether or not it's consciousness that constitutes human life. That's a discussion that I think, personally, I think is worth having. But that would be the only reason to open up that particular can of worms again.
Gary Greenberg is my guest. The new book is called The Noble Lie, When Scientists Give the Right Answers for the Wrong Reasons. Let's speak next to L.A. and Fort Worth. Hi, L.A.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Perhaps I just got in on the discussion a little late, so I apologize if I'm making a comment that's been answered. But the show is really interesting, and I know that your expert could explain this further. But I was under the impression, and I believe that I've read statistics, that alcohol destroys brain cells. And I thought that that would be categorized as a disease because that is a proven fact. And also I thought it had been proven that some people metabolize alcohol differently. It's been described as like having a diabetic, and that some people just cannot drink because their bodies don't metabolize it well. So I was confused on whether, you know, because to me that would seem like a disease. And I'll just take your answer off the air.
Thanks for your call. I know there are things that Gary addresses in the book, so if you'd like to
respond. Those are great questions. The first one is, you know, sure, that's right. You drink alcohol, enough alcohol, and it will cause some kind of brain damage. And the disease in question is not alcoholism, it's brain damage of some kind of organic brain syndrome or whatever. And there are identifiable brain syndromes that are related to alcohol consumption. The second question, though, is, you know, is there a metabolism that's unique to alcoholics? And the answer, as far as I know, is possibly, but so far it hasn't been definitively shown. I mean, it's a nice idea to account for the fact that clearly people differ in their ability to stop drinking when they need to stop drinking. And that difference tends to run in families. And it's very, very tempting to say, therefore, it's organic. And once we say that, you know, it's two steps away from just saying it's a disease. But this model, call it the allergy model, is precisely where they started in the 1940s. And it's, for all intents and purposes, it's been abandoned because all the attempts to prove it failed. Now, again, this isn't to say that people don't differ in their ability to drink and to stop drinking and in the effects alcohol has on them, but that has not been traced to a biological cause, which is what we usually mean when we're talking about a disease.
I don't want to spend too much of the rest of the conversation talking about alcoholism, only because that's not the only thing the book is about. But I do want to ask for a minute about the pronouncement that alcoholism was, A disease, and B, an incurable disease for a lifetime, which is to say that it was sort of agreed upon decades ago that anyone who had a drinking problem would always have one and really couldn't get near alcohol again without lapsing into that same addiction.
Right. And again, that's a classic example of a statement that can't be proved. Now, having said that, there are many people who have really benefited from believing that what they have is essentially an allergy that means they can't drink again because it helps them not to drink. And clearly, drinking has been a really bad thing in their lives. But having said that, it's not clear that calling something an incurable disease means that it's an incurable disease. And when you do that, there's a certain price that you pay. It's a price of kind of a debility, a sense of yourself as continually ill, of having a chronic illness, that, you know, that cuts both ways. I thought that the caller's comparison to diabetes was really interesting, because almost any time that you see one of these diseases that doesn't quite fit, the tendency is for somebody to compare it to diabetes. Because diabetes is a disease which requires a daily infusion of something. It's a chronic incurable disease that needs constant treatment.
How much of this discussion do you think will change, Gary, once we really know sometime in the future what every single gene in the human genome does and predisposes us to?
Yeah, boy, there's an interesting question. I think that given the way that we already understand disease, I think that when the genome is unpacked, it's going to be very tempting to start to look for correspondences between genetics and disease. But any decent geneticist is going to tell you that the difference between a genotype and a phenotype is enormous and unlikely to be bridged even by the finest study of the genome.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Gary Greenberg about his new book, The Noble Lie. Let's go next to Richard in Arlington. Hi, Richard.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I feel like I've suffered, you know, since my teens from depression as it's defined in all the literature. And for the last 10 or so years, I've been on SSRIs, mostly, and have been off of them too during that time. My experience is whether I'm on SSRIs or not, I'll eventually kind of recover from a major depressive episode, you know, usually after weeks or maybe even months. So I'm dubious about the effectiveness, efficacy, or whatever of those drugs, because it does take so long after you start taking them for them to have any kind of effect. And so I'm wondering if they're having any effect at all, since I do recover with or without them. And I wanted to make a comment that I feel like I have I feel guilty. I have a feeling of social responsibility to stay on them. And the doctors say, you're going to be on these all, you know, the rest of your life, so just accept it. So I just kind of wanted to hear what the doctor had to say about that.
Thanks for your call.
Every time some doctor tells a patient that he's going to have to be on these drugs for the rest of their lives, an executive at an insurance at a pharmaceutical company goes cha-ching, because that's really what that's the bread and butter of the antidepressant industry. Not treating people for acute depressive episodes, whatever their origin, but having people for their lives be taking these drugs. You know, the caller's with his name Richard.
Richard.
Yeah, Richard's. Response, I think, is very typical. He's confused because he's had some experience of feeling better on the drugs, but he's also had some experience of feeling better without the drugs. And he doesn't know, because you can't live an experimental life and a control life at the same time, if that means that the drugs work. And yet he feels obligated to take them. And so there's an example of how the disease model has confused somebody, rather than brought clarity to them.
You write about not just drugs for depression, but for a variety of conditions, and the fact that we may not hear so much about the studies where drugs are not successful.
Well, that's right. I mean, in general, in the FDA's method of approving drugs, the drug company simply has to present a couple of studies. I shouldn't say simply, it's a very laborious process, but they have to present two independent studies that show that the drug is more effective than a placebo, and this is about any drug. And it doesn't say, they don't say how many studies you can run that fail before you come up with your successful trials. The ones that are failures just don't count. It's like going to school, and instead of getting Fs, you just don't get credit for the courses you fail.
And again, for people who say, well, the drugs work for me, you're not arguing that they shouldn't have access to them.
No, not at all. I mean, in some ways, I wish the drugs were better. They are lousy performers in clinical trials and in people's real lives, unfortunately. So no, I'm not saying that at all. Am I saying that depression, as an example, hasn't existed as an illness for thousands of years?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Vivian in Dallas. Hi, Vivian.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question has in relation to the condition ADD or ADHD. It just seems like recently there's been an awful number of kids being diagnosed with this condition. And I'm just wondering if this has nothing to do, or if anything to do with the obviously increasing number of drugs that are manufactured to treat this condition. Is this a real condition, or is it just one of those royal misdiagnoses?
ADD is something that I didn't cover in this book, and some people have covered it quite ably, but the short answer is that it would appear that the disease is getting diagnosed more and more often, but that there's no known biological reason for that. In fact, it would appear that ADHD is often diagnosed in people who 10 or 15 years ago wouldn't have qualified for the diagnosis. And the funny part about ADHD is that the drugs used to treat it, which are stimulants, that is amphetamine and a drug called Ritalin, make people concentrate better. So once you start taking the drug, it becomes evidence that you had the disease in the first place.
Gary Greenberg is my guest. He's a psychotherapist and a freelance writer. His new book is called The Noble Lie, When Scientists Give the Right Answers for the Wrong Reasons. We'll be back to our discussion in just a moment. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is psychotherapist and freelance writer Dr. Gary Greenberg. His new book is called The Noble Lie, When Scientists Give the Right Answers for the Wrong Reasons. You were talking before the break, Gary, about the fact that a lot of ADHD people who are diagnosed would not have fit under the criteria for the disease 10 or 15 years ago. Now, there are people who would respond to that by saying, well, before people were suffering in silence, we are more enlightened now, and there is no longer a stigma that sort of blames people who have this condition for bad behavior. There's a recognition that there is something different going on in their brains. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think there's probably that's a reasonable argument. I don't know if it's a valid argument, and it's one that is very difficult to verify. But there are a number of logical leaps, and the last part about how therefore it's a disease in the brain, that's the hardest to verify. Because how are you going to prove that? I mean, everything happens regarding consciousness happens in the brain, but that doesn't mean that it's sort of caused spontaneously by the brain. You could stick a person with ADHD in an MRI and have them do some cognitive task and say, well, that brain lights up differently from somebody else's brain, but that doesn't really prove that it's a brain disease.
We have an email from Sean in Coppell who says, one big driver in defining things as diseases is that in many cases a person can't get insurance or government benefits to kick in for treatment of something that bothers them that is not defined as a disease.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's probably one of the major drivers.
So do you think that people who have these conditions are driving as much as the drug companies that are trying to push treatments?
Yes, and not only because of the economics. I mean, there are people out who suffer. Let's take people with fibromyalgia as an example.
Which is a sort of a chronic pain that is hard to define.
Chronic pain, fatigue, sort of vague symptoms that, you know, 100 years ago would have been called neurasthenia. And as there have been sort of biological correlates that have turned up to fibromyalgia, largely because drug companies are looking for targets, the disease takes on a kind of legitimacy. And so people who have been pathologized because, you know, there's something wrong with them in the head would prefer to be pathologized for having fibromyalgia. And then maybe that's an improvement. I'm not in a position to say, but it definitely works to make people feel better.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Susanna in Dallas. Hi, Susanna.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I appreciate your guest being there. My comment is I have depression, but the beauty part about living today is that we've got the internet to do more research. And with everything, with any disease or whatever you want to call it, there is no black and white. It can be genetics, like, and as a general, as Gary mentioned earlier, it can be your environment, it can be genetics, your values, decision making, etc. And so with the internet, what I have done is done research on other ways that I can improve my mental state by exercising, by disciplining my brain, for instance, with groups like Recovery International. And so, I mean, there's other ways. And then eventually, if you want to wean off your medication, just, you know, consult with your doctor. But there are other ways, like exercising. So it's not just take the medicine forever and that's it. Look on the internet and talk to other people. And there are other ways to, what I call organically, get better. Do your part to get better. Don't just depend on the doctors and the pill. That's all I have to say.
Thanks for your call.
Right. Well, it's hard to argue with doing whatever you can to make yourself feel better.
Do you worry that you know, Susanna made some great points, and I think a lot of people can identify with her. There might be someone else who is unable, without professional help, without medication, to get beyond their depression. Do you worry that sort of arguing this point about whether it's a disease or not really puts people who can't fix things on their own in a place that makes them susceptible to being stigmatized?
You mean, am I worried that people are going to listen to me instead of one of the largest industries in the country?
Apparently, you're not.
No, I like your program, and I'm sure a lot of people listen to it and take it seriously, but I'm way outgunned.
Was it a risk to your career to put a book out like this?
Not really. No, I mean, there's no risk to my career, such as it is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Daniel in Dallas. Hey, Daniel.
Hey there. Enjoy the program very much.
Thank you.
I'm in healthcare. I'll just leave it at that. And I work with traumatic brain injury and brain death as a living, let's just say, and have participated in many, many withdrawals of care as a result of the diagnosis of brain death. And it's a fascinating kind of notion, and I guess truth, that, you know, the diagnosis of brain death is not necessarily quote-unquote scientific, even though, of course, we have to use the scientific method to get there, and there are very specific steps that we take in order to diagnose and determine what we would call brain death. But the point that I would make about it is that even though the origin of how the definition of brain death came about might have had something to do with the idea of transplantation of organs, I think the way that the conversation was going, and this is not an accusation at all, I just wanted to make the point that it seemed to kind of go more in the direction about it, the necessity of it being about transplantation, when in reality, I participate in many, many withdrawals of care that have zero to do with transplantation of organs and really have more to do with the idea of quote-unquote quality of life, not only for the patient, but for the caregivers that might be taking care of them once they leave whatever facility that, you know, that they go to after they leave us. And just kind of wanted to hear the guests' comments about that well as a way to kind of equal it out.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I mean, and I heard as I was talking, I could hear that this was a problem in what I was saying. The withdrawal of care as the caller knows, is a question of really letting somebody die. You withdraw breathing, you withdraw nutrition, you withdraw hydration. Whatever you withdraw is a matter of letting people die. And that's a whole different world from brain death. In brain death, the person is declared dead. Now, there may be other reasons to declare a person dead rather than simply withdraw care. That is to declare them dead while they're still on the machines and still breathing, etc. But the only one that I'm aware of is organ transplant. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I could easily be wrong about that. But my sense is that the difficult decision is the one about the withdrawal of care. And there isn't anybody, any physician who's going to come and tell you, well, your loved one is dead if what's happened is really they're just in a severely brain-damaged state. And then it is a decision about quality of life.
You have some interesting assessments in the book about this debate that we're having right now over steroids. We've decided that these are bad, that they are somehow outside of the realm of what should be acceptable. And yet many of us, you know, enhance performance at work with Red Bull, and we, you know, people use Viagra and caffeine and all kinds of different things. Why do you think that we're able to sort of classify certain drugs as being not allowed, whereas other ones are okay?
Well, with steroids, you know, you're in one of the temples of American culture, which is sports. And, you know, people do, in general, expect a kind of moral purity from their athletic heroes that, you know, it's sort of insane to expect, but there it is. So, you know, why don't we allow athletes to enhance themselves? Why does Lance Armstrong have to essentially submit to a public colonoscopy every time he opens his mouth? It's because in elevating somebody to a level of adoration, we demand something back from them. And the thing that we seem to demand from our athletes is this kind of purity of bodily fluids. To me, it's ridiculous. I could take a lot of steroids and not come close to hitting a baseball like Barry Bonds does. To me, it's more about sort of it's like discovering gambling in Casablanca. Oh, my God, baseball players cheat. You know, you see, you're not going to have congressional hearings about corked bats. Gaylord Perry, who's a spitball pitcher, is in the Hall of Fame. So why one form of cheating is worse than another, I believe, has to do with the fact that it's regarding drugs, it's regarding taking things into your body, and I think in general we're very confused about that.
Well, the other really interesting thing about that question is that while we frown upon people using steroids and we frown upon people who, quote-unquote, self-medicate with illicit drugs and with alcohol, we really don't have a problem anymore with people using medications to help mental problems as long as they're prescribed by a doctor.
Well, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? I mean, recently a study came out and something about 20% of the scientists in the country copped to using Ritalin or Adderall, amphetamine, in their daily life, because it helped them focus, right? Now, the question I have for that is, would they cop to it publicly?
Hmm.
You know, would they, in the same way that somebody says, well, I use insulin? There's still a great deal of shame about enhancement that violates certain taboos about the body, the same ones that people violate when they pierce themselves in bizarre ways. So I don't know that we're all that comfortable with it, but certainly we're getting there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Louisville and speak to Brett. Hi, Brett.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Great show. I'm just really interested in what you think would happen if, you know, the government got behind research and development of drugs and, you know, instead of private industry and kind of targeted drugs and diseases, you know, instead of having independent companies do it where they're purely in a profit mode.
Yeah, it would probably be a whole lot less fun. I mean, the government's probably not going to get too exercised about restless leg syndrome. You know, that goes so against the American entrepreneurial spirit that I don't think it's going to happen. But in real life, the government is behind a lot of drug research. The pharmaceutical companies are using research generated by National Institutes of Health grants all the time. But I think if the real question here is, you know, is there a way to stop the drug industry from disease mongering? No, I mean they're out to make a profit, and that's what they're supposed to do. And the best way to do that is to find an audience or a market. And for a drug company, a market is sick people.
Do you see parallels in everyday life and in the culture we've developed where, so many magazines tell women and increasingly men what they're supposed to look like and sort of identify a flaw in people so that they will buy a product?
Sure. I mean, it's actually, whether it's your physical appearance or the way you're supposed to feel on the inside or, how your breath is supposed to smell, this is the heart of mass consumer society, is convincing people that they've got a deficiency that you just happen to have the remedy for.
So is it mostly economics that shapes our visions of the sort of person that we ought to be and the sort of life we ought to live?
To the extent that advertising shapes us, yeah. I mean, there are other forces, but advertising is a very, very powerful one, and advertising isn't just, the jingles that play on your television. Advertising is ubiquitous.
So we need to be having these conversations, but you're concerned that bioethicists these days are focusing on the process of how we make these decisions as opposed to the actual content.
Yeah, you caught that little dig. I got it in one sentence and never said anything else about it. Huh?
Well, how has this happened, and why does it worry you?
Well, it doesn't particularly worry me. It's just that the profession has developed into a profession whose job is to solve problems for the healthcare field. And some of them are more, sort of friendly with the hospitals and the doctors than others. But their job is to figure out how we can implement these technologies in the best way possible or, under certain circumstances, whether we should do it at all. And they're just not – it's bioethics may have started as a public philosophy discipline, but it just isn't anymore.
So where do you imagine we go from here? Do you think that, 20 years from now, every single thing that is not optimal about us will be declared a disease?
Well, I hope not. I mean, I hope that, in my ideal world, people can decide what's optimal and take care of it however they want without having to think that they were diseased in the first place.
And do you think that Americans are thinking about these things? I mean, obviously you wrote the book to sort of raise people's thinking about this issue. Do you think Americans give much thought to it, or do you think for most people all of these things are foregone conclusions and they've heard a doctor say it, or they've heard it on TV?
I actually think what happens is that people there's a big contrast between people's thoughts and people's behavior. In this particular area, same people who will condemn Barry Bonds will drink six cups of coffee to make their minds focus sharper. I don't mean to say that this is hypocrisy. I just think it's really impossible to negotiate the world that we live in today without being in a constant state of flux about what your convictions are and how they ought to be lived out in your daily life.
Gary Greenberg is a freelance writer and a psychotherapist. His new book is called The Noble Lie, When Scientists Give the Right Answers for the Wrong Reasons. Gary, very interesting hour. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.